Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and welcome back to the weekly roundtable edition of The Bunker with me, Andrew Harrison. On this week's podcast, we have a very special guest, former US intelligence analyst Fiona Hill, who gave that explosive testimony to the Senate Intelligence Committee 2 years ago this week and thus became the world's most famous Macam. She joins us to talk about the continuing Trump effect on US politics and how inequality and lack of opportunity are driving Western democracies down the path of populism. Plus, we'll be looking at how populists are faring elsewhere in the world, from France to Hungary. We'll be asking whether a political pop song has ever changed our minds. And we've got some very big news about a new podcast from the House of the Bunker. All that and more on this week's Bunker Podcast. Welcome back to The Bunker. Before we start, that big news is we are launching an exciting new podcast, a documentary series presented by Bunker favourite Arthur Snell. It's called Doomsday Watch, and it looks at all the threats to global stability that don't get enough attention from conventional media. It's unlike anything we've done before. It's really, really good, and it's out to listen to right now. As regulars know, Arthur understands the geopolitical world better than anybody, and he has got his unrivaled contacts together to look at everything from what happens to the Middle East when people stop buying their oil to the possibility of a second American Civil War. It sounds amazing. It's even got exclusive music from Paul Hartnell of Orbital, and you can get it wherever you get your podcasts, or just follow the link. We've put a link at the top of the show notes so you can have a listen after you've listened to this week's Bunker. Obviously, we'd love to know what you think about it. Right, that's enough plugging. Let's meet today's panel. First up, welcome back to freelance Westminster reporter and author Marie LeConte. Hello, Marie.
Hello.
So the big story this week has been the fallout from the Owen Paterson affair. What has the vibe been like on your beat this week?
I mean, it's been really fun, I'd say, personally. I've generally just quite enjoyed the past week. But no, more seriously, I mean, I don't think I have anything overly surprising to say. I think there's been a lot of anger from Conservative MPs because they feel that, you know, that they were made to look like complete fools. Quite a lot of them did not want to vote for that amendment last week and then were made to because of the three-line whip. Or, you know, all for that, so like for people to use. And in the end, and I think quite a few of them do have legitimate concerns about the current system and the watchdog and now feel that basically there's kind of no way to change it for the foreseeable future because that's become so politically toxic. And yeah, and I think my favorite WhatsApp message from a Tory MP last week was one that literally just read, "Christ."
I think that's the message we've all been sending for the past 5 years, really, to one another, isn't it, really? So Johnson didn't turn up for the debate today to in any way explain what was going on. He's busy in a hospital, apparently. Have you absorbed any reaction from the Conservative Party about his refusal to turn up and face the music?
I've not actually, to be completely honest, because I was busy writing about the Paterson stuff today. I've not really talked to many people about it. But I think it's also, but again, not unlike the rest of the country, it's not just the Paterson stuff. It's, you know, and again, that's been well covered in the papers as well, but it's the fact that a similar thing happened with Dominic Cummings and Barnard Castle. That it just, that sort of stuff keeps happening. And I think parliamentary management or lack thereof from Number 10 is just a massive issue because you do have all these MPs, and especially I think, you know, not to get too nerdy, but I think because they're such a massive parliamentary party, they can't really do what basically Theresa May did, which was give jobs to everyone. You know, there was a point towards the end of the May years where every single Conservative MP had some sort of payroll job. Boris can't do that. So I think you're going to end up having more and more MPs who are grumpier and grumpier. And also, again, who can't really be sweetened by the whips with anything because there's just not enough jobs to go around.
Also back on The Bunker, welcome to the Atlantic staff writer Yasmin Serhan. Hello, Yasmin.
Hello.
So COP26 is reaching crunch time this week. The attendees have to find ways to deliver what's been promised. And Greta Thunberg was there. You've been writing about her this week, about how the far right hate her. Depictions of her as a spoiled child, a leftist pawn, and even a Nazi. Why do old men hate Greta Thunberg so much? He asked rhetorically.
Well, I think, you know, Greta Thunberg isn't the first famous or high profile figure upon which the far right have projected their vitriol and hatred. The difference, I think, though, is that unlike, say, you know, George Soros or Bill Gates, she is neither, you know, a very powerful man or a billionaire or anything like that. But she is, you know, she is powerful in her own right. And I think that's why, that's the reason there's such a fixation on her. I actually got to writing about Greta because I was doing a piece published not too long ago, basically about sort of how the far right perspective on or arguments on climate change are changing. They're kind of shifting from outright denialism to this sort of notion of like, yes, man-made climate change is a thing, but you know, all these policies that the elites are pushing are going to harm real working people like you and me. And what I found, which was really quite grim, is just all these memes of her. And you know, they're all more or less along the same sort of genre. They depict her as kind of Hitler Youth, as being sort of controlled by, you know, the likes of kind of some of those other sort of favorite far-right targets like George Soros. And that's where we see these sort of memes of her being a schoolgirl puppet or someone who's being exploited by her fame-hungry parents and stuff like that. I don't think it helps, of course, that we're seeing some of the most powerful leaders in the world being among those people who are making fun of her. Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil called her a brat. I saw a member of Germany's AfD basically called her an icon of the climate church. And of course, you know, perhaps her most vocal critic was Donald Trump, who she used to spar with on Twitter quite regularly, if you all remember, at least until he was booted off the platform. But, you know, I mean, I think in large part, what all these sort of, you know, particularly misogynistic and ableist attacks on Greta are a testament to is the fact that she's really hard to discredit. And that's not just because of her age. You know, I think the problem with Greta, or at least among her detractors, is that she's quite genuine in that, you know, I'm pretty sure she's vegan. She doesn't, you know, she abstains from plane travel. She avoids mass consumerism. You know, she's really someone that's kind of hard to sort of pin down and be like, look, they're a hypocrite. You shouldn't listen to them. And I think crucially also, she's not a politician either. So they can't really go after her for making sort of policy decisions because, you know, she quite openly says she wants to leave the policy to the policymakers. Her activism is very much rooted in science. So I think those are kind of all the reasons that we're seeing her being this we're seeing what I like to call the Sorosification of, not very easy to say, the Sorosification of Greta Thunberg. And I suspect we'll probably see more of it the more high profile she is and becomes.
We've got a real star for today's special guest. Fiona Hill was an intelligence analyst in both the Bush and Obama administrations and a senior director of the National Security Council under Donald Trump. 2 years ago, she delivered utterly devastating testimony on Capitol Hill in the matter of Trump's impeachment and specifically the hoax that Ukraine, not Russia, had interfered in US elections. She became an instant star, not just for her brilliant British northeastern accent. She was born in County Durham and became a US citizen in 2002, but also for setting out how clearly Trump and the Republicans were intent on destroying the American dream that drew her to the US in the first place. She's since returned to a career in academia, and her memoir, There Is Nothing For You, describes how lack of opportunity for working class people is setting the United States on the same nihilistic path as modern Russia. The title is a quote from her coal miner dad who told her to leave the area. There's nothing for you here, pet. She's with us today. Fiona Hill, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the bunker.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you guys.
So I was in the US when you were delivering your testimony. I was visiting family and they were standing around the television wrapped with open mouths. I mean, did you suspect at the time that you're going to make that sort of an impact with your evidence?
No, I had no idea. I mean, I just wanted to, you know, show up and do my job, tell the truth, obviously, bear witness along with the other colleagues who had been subpoenaed. And I was just, you know, very focused on answering the questions and, you know, also figuring out for myself, I guess, what had happened, because I didn't have complete information on what was going on every issue. And over the course of the depositions, because I had these closed door depositions in the October before the public testimony on, you know, I mean, essentially this time, you know, 2 years ago, as you said, and I also had a lot of questions, and over the course of the depositions and then the public testimony, because I came at the very end of it with another colleague, David Holmes, I figured out bits for myself about what had been going on. So in real time, I was having the same experience as everyone else of like, oh, really? So, you know, now I've got it. And I think, you know, partly because I was also in the moment with everyone else, you know, perhaps that had an impact too, because I was just, as I said, you know, trying to focus on what I was being asked, what I knew, and what else I could figure out about what was going on. But I had no idea about the impact that it would have. You know, I was gobsmacked, to be honest, you know, afterwards.
So, I mean, you had gone to work for Trump because as a public servant, you know, it is your duty. And you were the US's top Russia expert. You'd co-written a book called Mr. Putin, Operative in Kremlin, about how his KGB mindset kind of determines everything he does. Did you have any trepidation about working for Trump when you joined the team?
Well, I did. I mean, particularly given all of the toxic partisan politics that was going on in the US at the time, you know, all the swirl around the elections, Trump saw on very evident sexism, misogyny, and, you know, a lot of the racist comments that he was making. I mean, I did worry about that, but I worried more, honestly, at the time about what the Russian intelligence services had been up to. I mean, they'd really made one hell of a mess in the US domestic political system. And of course, people worried in the UK too, that they'd been involved somewhere behind the scenes in Brexit and, you know, many other issues. And I really felt that I had to step up when I was asked to do so, because, I mean, otherwise, what was I going to do? Just stand around on the sidelines and watch all of this happen?
Were you aware of concrete evidence of him being personally compromised? Because obviously a lot's come out, you know, before and since, a lot of rumour and a lot of kind of half-substantiated stuff. Were you personally aware that there was concrete stuff about his vulnerability to Russian pressure?
Look, there was a lot of rumour about it. I mean, there's been this big scandal about, you know, the dossier and everything that's been going on here in the US and elsewhere. I was more concerned about what the Russians were doing across the board, because it was clear that they were looking for any opening into any of the campaigns. I knew personally that people had been trying to make contact with a number of the other Republican Party candidate campaigns. I mean, I'd actually seen it and witnessed it, and also trying to, you know, figure out ways into the Clinton campaign. So there was a lot of activity going on there. And it seemed to me that the Trump campaign was quite vulnerable to this because they didn't really have a lot of expertise on Russia internally. And, you know, I worried a lot that Trump himself and people around him didn't quite understand what they were dealing with based on a lot of the public commentary, you know, particularly when he was kind of goading, you know, the Russians to release Hillary Clinton's emails. I mean, he was kind of messing with all of this stuff. I mean, clearly he was quite willing to take information from any source. But I was worried about, you know, really doing this properly so that people could see what the Russians had done, you know, writ large, and how dangerous this was for US national security.
We're going to talk in more detail about Trump and also the political power of opportunity and withholding opportunity in a minute. But Fiona, I've got to say, you're now probably the most famous MacIm in the United States. And Americans tend to expect British people, I know this from personal experience, they expect you to talk like Prince Charles, and when you don't, they find it a bit strange. How have people reacted to your accent? Has it opened doors or closed doors, do you think?
Well, certainly, I mean, from the very beginning, people can't distinguish accents from the UK in the US very easily. I mean, often a distinctive accent, they think, you know, if it's not the BBC English, then maybe a Scottish. I've often been thought of being Scottish, and I did go to university in Scotland, of course. And then they think that it might be Australian or from South Africa, maybe New Zealand. You know, they have a hard time with it. And the funny thing is, when I get, I've been attacked quite a lot recently by the right-wing media, a bit like Greta Thunberg, but she obviously gets a lot of it. I'm getting a lot of it at the moment. But Laura Ingraham, one of the, you know, kind of Fox News, who I'm sure you're very familiar with, referred to me after the testimony as having a hoity-toity Prince Andrew accent, which was, I mean, I just sort of fell about laughing.
That's fantastic.
I thought, wow. And Prince Andrew, of all people, why Prince Andrew? Do I sound like Prince Andrew? I don't think so. Anyway, it was just so weird. And I just realized that, you know, people just can't distinguish British accent. And as a result of that, yes, it did open doors, because no one was saying, oh, there's this weird northern lass, you know, here. It was just, oh, there's this British person, you know, kind of. Yeah.
Did take it over US citizenship until giving up your football team then? Was it Sunderland or Borough?
Well, actually, I'm afraid I'm a little bit of an all over the place, because when I was a kid, we used to sometimes go and watch Newcastle United basically practice, because my dad knew quite a lot of people from around in the old football world. From he used to play in the amateur leagues, you know, back in the day. And for whatever reason, it was easier to get to Newcastle to watch the practice than it was to get to Sunderland, Middlesbrough, which is a big telling point here in the UK. Right, it was actually more easy to get to Newcastle, which was further away than for Sunderland and Middlesbrough. But I did go to see Sunderland a couple of times.
So Fiona, you've talked a bit about the experience of giving evidence to the Intelligence Committee, and you've also hinted at, you know, the people who oppose Donald Trump tend to be targeted. You just mentioned Laura Ingraham. Has that happened to you? You know, have you had, you know, what does this Brit know anyway?
I've got it all the time. It's happening now as well, actually. And, you know, when Yasmin was talking about the Sorosification, which is a good word, I mean, I've had that too. I was accused of being the Soros mole in the White House. Apparently myself and the first national security advisor I worked with, General McMaster, we were part of a Soros conspiracy to take down the president. You know, Soros is the kind of catch-all for everyone. I actually talked about that in the testimony, talking about how this was just the latest variant of, you know, these horrible, historic, anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Now it's the Protocols of the Elders of Soros. I don't know what they're going to do when Mr. Soros passes away. I mean, he's quite elderly. Are they going to transfer it to his sons, or are they going to transfer it to someone else? Because it's clearly, if he didn't exist, they'd have to make it up. And in fact, it is made up. There's a whole information about how this came about, this Soros idea, because it was designed by two political technologists, initially for Viktor Orban in Hungary, as, you know, kind of a sort of straw man figure to run against, a kind of a stalking horse. I mean, Soros was just repurposed then for the United States as well, and became a foil for Donald Trump. I mean, it's pretty crazy. And the problem is, for people, everything's too complex, it's too difficult, like climate change. So it's much easier to push things away and blame people and, you know, kind of basically make excuses why things can't be done, than it is to actually try to tackle them.
You've worked for three different presidents, very, very different presidents, George W. Bush, Barack Obama and Trump. In the course of working on intelligence for these hugely disparate characters, were there kind of commonalities between them? Is there somewhere beneath the presentation and the political direction a kind of unity of direction on intelligence?
Not really. Mm. I mean, Bush and Obama were very intellectually curious. They were well versed in a lot of the issues. I'm afraid I can't say that about Trump. I mean, they had a very different style. Bush liked to have a interaction. He used to call them deep dives, where he'd ask a lot of questions. You'd talk backwards and forwards. He wasn't so keen on, you know, reading the material, where Obama would have prepared himself, read all the material, and just ask a couple of judicious questions. But they were both, you know, clearly masters of it. Trump, you know, didn't like to read the material, but didn't like to, you know, really hear anything from anyone else. There was one common thread, though. All three of them did want to try to put the relationship with Russia on a different pathway. You remember Bush very famously talked about looking into Putin's eyes in Slovenia and his first meeting and seeing his soul. He was trying to, you know, find a bit of strategic empathy there to make a connection. Of course, he got totally made fun of for that one. But Obama tried the reset, although at that point Putin wasn't in the presidency. It was Dmitry Medvedev who was sort of standing in for Putin at the period. And Trump really did want to change the direction of the relationship, but he was pretty much exclusively focused on Putin himself and charming him and, you know, having the kind of the big strongman sit down and not thinking about the overall US-Russia relationship.
It's the curse of advisors, often for the advice to not be taken or not to be fully taken. At any point in the course of working with these three presidents, if you'd had a magic wand that could, or you'd had a kind of a joker card, you just got to obey my advice on this one, what would it have been? What trick has America continued to miss?
Well, I think it's constantly, as George Bush would have said in one of his great, you know, mangling of the English language, misunderestimating Russia. I mean, I love that one. I really actually thought that should make it into the dictionary. And it's, you know, the idea that, you know, kind of you can wait Russia out, that it's just going to kind of fade away and disappear because it always looks weak. Well, it's always looked like that. Or conversely, that it's super strong and can, you know, do absolutely anything. You know, sometimes overestimating sometimes, you know, what Russia can do. So it's just kind of right-sizing it and, you know, understanding that Russia is going to be a factor in international relations. It's not going anywhere. It's the biggest country in landmass on the map. And that the Russians are always, you know, when they worry about their own security, which is all they ever do is worry about their security and think everything's about them, that they will always be able to find a way of deploying resources to push back at any threat. The word in Russian for security is bezopasnost, which means without danger. And we all know that the world is filled with danger. You're never going to get a world without danger. So, you know, the Russia's views of security is always extremes. How can they get rid of all danger, all risk, all peril? And so you've got to bear in mind that that's the way that they think of the world, how to basically remove and eradicate any kind of source of threat. So even if we don't have malintent, but we have the capability to hurt them, they're going to try to marginalise us.
You were Trump's advisor around the time of the Helsinki meeting, which is another moment when I was in America with my friends and relatives watching agog at the way the president behaved. How did you feel about that terrible press conference that he gave where he more or less grovelled and he more or less threw the FBI under the bus?
Well, I felt it was a terrible press conference like everybody else did. And it was, you know, completely disassociated from the rest of the meeting that had been, you know, in relative terms, fairly normal in terms of how these big meetings tend to go. I mean, there were a few elements that weren't great about it, but generally we were trying to move along on this track of trying to stabilize the relationship in some way and set up a series of other meetings, particularly on arms control. But of course, Trump was completely and utterly paranoid about being asked about 2016 and what the Russian security service had done. I think his biggest fear was that Vladimir Putin might have said at some point, yeah, I did it, actually, Donald, I did. I interfered and I got you the election. I mean, that would have just blown Trump out of the water, the rest of us as well, because, you know, we'd given them too much credit for what they did. You know, and over the course of my time in the administration and all the time since, and, you know, I laid this out in the book, the Russians just exploited our own vulnerabilities and problems. We created the mess and they just, you know, piled on and took advantage of it. But if Trump had actually asked Putin outright, and he never did, he would have, you know, been extraordinarily fearful of that answer. So he was always trying to deflect. And he also didn't want to be shown up in front of Putin, because Putin was his ideal strongman type, the guy who's really in charge of the country, no checks and balances. You know, he's the autocrat. He's rich, he's famous, he's powerful. Everybody knows who he is. And that's what Trump wanted to be. And so he always wanted to, you know, stand in the sort of reflected glow of Vladimir Putin and not be challenged in front of him. So he just lashed out. And that's, we saw it all happen in real time.
How do you think the Russians see Trump now? Do they want him back? Are they making efforts to get him back?
I don't know whether they're making efforts to get him back. I think, you know, he, for them, has shown the United States in the light that they've said we've been in all the time. I mean, they've always said we were full of it, you know, hubris, you know, we're no better than anyone else. And from their perspective, Trump definitely demonstrated that. However, I do think that they were concerned that they couldn't get any kind of agreements out of the United States while he was in office, that it was just chaos. It was always too much. And even after that Helsinki press conference, when Putin was exiting the hall, even he thought it had gone too far, because he knew that all of the arrangements that we'd made to have the National Security Councils meet with each other would just kind of end up in disaster after that. So I think he would have liked, okay, he liked the chaos, he liked the division, he liked the United States showing itself up, he liked the fact that our democracy looked like it was all over the place. You know, he just loves that sort of division and discord, but he also wanted something concrete out of it and he wasn't getting it. And I think that's, you know, what's going on behind the scenes right now with the Biden administration. They're trying to lock in, you know, some agreements on arms control and cyber security issues that they were trying to get the entire time that Trump was in office, and they got nowhere with. And remember, they didn't want the United States to pull out of the JCPOA, the Iran agreement. They don't necessarily want the United States to pull out the Paris Accord either, the Paris climate change. They like international agreements. They like to be part of all of this. And, you know, they like that multilateralism because that, you know, gives them a stage to operate on. So the United States going it alone wasn't necessarily what they wanted to see.
So the impeachment failed, Trump lost but refused to accept it, and there was an attack on the Capitol building on January the 6th. What's your assessment on how much the paranoid anti-government strain in US politics has worsened? Like, do you think we're in a worse place now than in November 2019?
I do. I mean, because it's everything, like you're saying, Marie, it's all that unfolding of events. You know, I'm extraordinarily, you know, worried about it. I mean, I think the populist element, the right-wing element has got more acute. You know, they're looking for revenge on, you know, kind of people who, you know, thwarted Trump's efforts to stay in power. I mean, he certainly is. And, you know, kind of whipping up all of these sentiments, these political sentiments and the divisions even more so in the United States. I'm really worried about it. I'm really worried about where the United States is headed right now.
Now, that makes sense. And so last week, obviously, the Democrats lost the Virginia governorship in what we've seen as a kind of referendum on Biden's presidency. And even though, so the candidate was not a massive sort of like Trumper himself, are you worried at all about the kind of spectre of Trump returning?
I am. I mean, I think it's entirely possible. I mean, he certainly banked Youngkin's win as governor in Virginia as one of his wins. Although, as you said, Youngkin was very clever and very careful clever and careful to basically distance himself slightly from Trump without really roiling up Trump's voter base. He obviously pocketed them and moved on. I mean, he played, kind of really fast and loose with the truth as well. It wasn't that he was really kind of giving credence to Trump's big lie about the election. He just avoided that one. But, you know, his many of his campaign was focused on culture and values issues, including the purported teaching of critical race theory, which has become a kind of red flag for all kinds of, you know, right-wing movements at this point in schools in Virginia. It's not taught in schools in Virginia. It's not taught in schools anywhere, you know, around the D.C. area. In fact, critical race theory, but I'm honest, I don't even know quite exactly what it is. I know that it was, you know, taught in some law schools, for example, looking at some of, you know, the entrenched racial discrimination in legal systems. But the idea that this is taught in schools is just feeding into people's anxieties as we're still in the midst of the pandemic about education and about the future of their children, you know, and all of the kind of issues that people are grappling with. But it was, you know, kind of a very cynical, I mean, most politics, unfortunately, these days are very cynical, but it was a very cynical manipulation of people's concerns in that race.
Yeah, that's right, Trin. So is there a world in which America recovers from Trump, you know, in the kind of foreseeable future? Now, what needs to be done? What needs to happen in order to repair the damage of his years in office?
Well, I think it has to be multifaceted, but you said, you know, his years in office, he's still around, right? You know, as you talked about earlier, as Yasmin did as well, about the climate change, you know, the way that this is being framed as giving, you know, real working people harm. Well, my dad was a coal miner and, you know, kind of he ended up with all kinds of lung conditions from working down the mines. Lots of my relatives had black lung. The rest of my family worked in ICI, you know, the big chemical works in Billingham. Several of my great uncles died of asbestosis, you know, acquired on the job. My mother had chronic asthma from living right at the factory gates from, you know, all of the emissions. You know, real working people get harmed by all kinds of things, contaminated water, emissions, occupational hazards in their jobs. I mean, they want jobs, but they also want health. And nobody wants dirty, contaminated water or, you know, kind of any of the other environmental problems. Ironically, all the miners I grew up with, ex-miners, were, you know, very into conservation of the environment because they loved the world above the ground, you know, when they got out. My dad was, you know, always out there tramping around in the countryside, you know, talking about how when he was down the mines, he hated being down and he loved, you know, being up on top. And so I think if things are managed and talked about in a serious way on these particular issues as well, you can start to work past the damage. We have to have sensible discussions about what we're talking about. But as you're suggesting, how do we do that? It can't just be happening on the top through Congress. There's obviously the infrastructure bills, the Build Back Better bill that Biden's trying to get through. But at each case and at state and local government, at community level, that's to be kind of like a dialogue about how things are going to shift. Because I think we're going to really lose the plot completely if we don't have direct discussions with working people in the current coal mines and, you know, steelworks and other industries about how we're going to transition to a new economy. And so many people are going to be, you know, left out of that if we don't directly engage. So I think we have to find mechanisms of direct engagement. I think, you know, Biden and other people, for example, are going to have to get out there. They're going to have to go to West Virginia. They're going to have to go out there to Pennsylvania and Ohio and elsewhere and talk about all of this. You know, just when I think about Glasgow and COP26, people have to fan out and talk to all of the communities that are going to be affected by all the changes that are going to be necessary. Not just the people who are going to be drowned and displaced, but the people who are going to be displaced. And I was thinking about, you know, the Tuvalu, you know, I saw the whole exhibition that they had there at Glasgow, which is very poignant and very, you know, right in your face there about, look, what's going to happen to us? But it's when talk to all the people who are going to lose jobs because of the need to change to clean technologies.
You obviously know, being an American yourself and having lived in the United States for quite some time, about the stories that we tell ourselves about America being, you know, a land of opportunity, a place where you can achieve the American dream, et cetera, et cetera. Like you, my parents immigrated to the United States. A fun fact for all of you is that they actually stopped in the UK first. They were coming from Kuwait after the Gulf War because we have family here. But my mom decided against moving here because of the rain. Anyway,
so that's a good move, actually.
Yeah, it turns out when you're fleeing from war, you can still take considerations into account, like the horrible British weather. But in any event, they wound up in California, which is a lot better. But, you know, they were also, I think, drawn by this notion of the American dream. And I'd like to think in a lot of ways they achieved it, being American citizens themselves now, owning a home, etc. I'm wondering from your vantage point, particularly given the hostility to immigration that we see in the U.S., do you think that dream or that message has been lost?
I think it has, because of developments, just as you're, you know, kind of pointing out, probably since that whole period when your parents came, actually, during, you know, kind of the Gulf War, I mean, back in the 1990s, I think we've seen a real shift. I came in 1989, just as the end of the Cold War. And obviously for me, every door opened an opportunity. But for, you know, everybody who was born in the 80s and 90s and moving onwards, I think they've seen a lot of shrinking of that same opportunity. In the United States now, there's only a 7% chance of basically social mobility from the bottom quintile, the bottom 20% to the top 20%. I mean, that's so far behind the rest of advanced OECD countries, though the UK isn't looking great either. And, you know, and even in places like Germany and elsewhere, it's really dropped down a bit. But, you know, the United States used to be more like a 50% chance, right? And the United States has become less mobile now than at any time since 1947. I came, you know, at the end of a period in which they were opening up educational opportunities, there were grants, there were subsidies. And then, of course, you know, fast forward, we have not just 9/11 and the great wrenching impact that that had with the forever wars and the kind of great drain of the coffers. There's also this attitude that education becomes an individual responsibility because only you are going to benefit individually, not everybody else. When I came, you know, on board in the United States, was still a sense that society itself was benefiting from everybody getting educated. There's the Pell grants, you know, very similar to the local education authority grants in the UK for the first people in their family to go to college. Then you've got the Great Recession and the huge impact of the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, and now you've got COVID. And I think that all of those hits to people and to their perspectives, and this idea that no longer is it a given that your kids are going to live better than you and your grandkids, this is really, I think, getting people caught up in this populist reaction. Because Trump, for one, says, I'm going to come in and fix it. And then, you know, a lot of the populist politicians are saying, well, the reason that all of this is going wrong is not this complex economic and socioeconomic changes, which are incredibly difficult to fix. It's because of your culture, values. Somebody else is coming in and taking it away. It's immigrants. When in fact, immigration in the United States now is lower than any other point than it's been before in any time in our recent history because of all the restrictions that go back years, going back to the Obama administration, in fact. Or it's, you know, these cosmopolitan, you know, elites and everybody's labeling everything. Or it's critical race theory, or it's this, or it's that, or the other. And the big problem is that this is going to take generations to fix. It's going to be multifaceted. It's not going to be, you know, sufficient even with the legislation going through the Congress. And it's also going to have to be, you know, we're hearing a lot, Yasmin, as well, I'm sure that you're watching this as well, about the rift between the rural and urban areas in the United States. It really showed up in the Virginia election, where rural areas pretty much overwhelmingly 80 to 90% voted for Youngkin, you know, really showing that lots of rural United States feels completely, you know, disassociated from, you know, the Democratic Party. We've got this strange development, which I would never have guessed when I first got there in 1989 in the United States, where people will identify themselves primarily as Democrats or Republicans. I mean, I didn't know anybody's political affiliation when I first got to the US. Not none whatsoever. I mean, I know in the UK people do, you know, Brexit versus Remain, and you guys have talked about this and, you know, many of your podcasts. But I'm shocked that people would say, hello, I'm a Democrat, or hello, I'm a Republican. I don't want to talk to the other side. I don't want my family, you know, basically marrying into the other side. It's like, this is nuts. So this is what the situation that we're grappling with. And I do think it has to be tackled physically, out from away from the internet, getting into communities, local areas, and getting people to physically meet with each other and talk about these things.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
We're on Constant Populism Watch here in the bunker, and things are still lively around the world as well as in the United States. In the Czech Republic, the billionaire populist Prime Minister Andrej Babiš suffered a shock defeat last month at the hands of a democratic bloc. The Pandora Papers helped to prove that you can't just not trust a Trump Czech, you can't trust a Czech Trump either. Hungary's populist Prime Minister Viktor Orban is in for his biggest test yet in next spring's general election, as six of the country's opposition parties have united around Catholic Conservative Mayor Peter Markize. But the right-wing populist Japan Innovation Party quadrupled its seats in that country's elections last week. What is going on? Yasmin, you're our resident expert on populism. What are the big trends at the moment? I mean, we're looking at Brazil, Hungary and France. What are the standouts?
Yeah, so all three of those countries are ones that I've been kind of looking at ahead of 2022, when we're going to be seeing big elections in all three of them. In France, we've got French President Emmanuel Macron going up against, could be Le Pen, could be a Kaigold Eric Zemmour, who's quickly emerged as a sort of Trumpian rival to Le Pen in the second round. Obviously, we're still about 6 months away from that election, so things could change, but it already kind of feels like that election is kicking into gear to be kind of another populist showdown. In Hungary, as you mentioned, there's the Hungarian election in the spring, and that will be a race between incumbent Viktor Orban and United Opposition, aka the Anti-Orban Alliance. The first of its kind, I think. It's made up of right-wing, left-wing, liberal, and green parties, and they've all basically banded together in the hope of unseating Orban after 12 years in power. And then the third election, which I'm also going to be following very closely next year, is in Brazil, and that's going to be pitting the incumbent President Jair Bolsonaro against former President Lula. So Bolsonaro has actually spent the last several months seeking to undermine the result of that contest well before it's even begun. He's suggested on multiple occasions that the country's electronic voting system is ripe for tampering, and even tried to bring back paper ballots, though that was unsuccessful. And he's also basically said that he will refuse to hand over power if he determines that there was any fraud. Funnily enough, Trump endorsed him last month, which in a lot of ways to me just sounded like he was endorsing his own legacy.
Mm. I mean, are we sort of wrong to sort of pin hopes on things like the Czech Republic? People were able to come together and get rid of their own mini populists. I mean, is the general trend around the world still worrying from your point of view?
I think the trend of clearly what seems to be this Trumpian legacy of sowing doubt in electoral contests and sowing doubt in trust, like basically trying to sow distrust in democracy, I think is pretty worrying. Obviously, it didn't work in Trump's instance. He's not in power. But I mean, you know, we're a year away from that election and we're still kind of reeling from it in a lot of ways. And I think really the legacy that he leaves isn't so much, it isn't a message to populist leaders that, oh, if you try to sow doubt or try to tell people that their elections aren't to be trusted, that you will win. What I think it does tell them is that actually elections come and go, but grievances forever. And even if you lose, and even if your attempt to potentially, you know, undo an election doesn't work, you can ride that wave of grievance from the next election to the next election, and you can galvanize your base. And, you know, that's what Trump has been able to do. We've seen it. We've just discussed kind of how that's played out in the last year. And I think in the event that, say, Bolsonaro loses, or indeed, even if Orban were to lose, and in that case, that would be, that's in a system that's already slanted in his favor in the form of gerrymandering and control of the media and state institutions, that, you know, even with all that, if they lose, that they can try to take control of the narrative and hopefully propel themselves back into power in the next election.
Marie, France is, could be looking at two senior far-right candidates in coming elections, not just Marine Le Pen that we're fairly familiar with, but also this Eric Zemmour character. Who is Zemmour? What's his background? What's he about?
I love that you describe them as senior far-right candidates. I love the idea of someone being like junior far-right.
Well, it's a trainee position. You know, you've kind of got to do your exams.
Eric Zemmour's quite an interesting one. So the beginning of his career was actually really not unlike Boris Johnson's. So in that he was a journalist, he was a columnist in Le Figaro, which is actually in many ways France's Daily Telegraph. So really the parallels are quite striking. And, you know, he appeared on television quite a lot, etc. And he was always like quite controversial. But his politics are considerably, I'd say, to the right of Boris. So, you know, he is very, very Islamophobic, anti-Semitic, racist in general, just, you know, so it's like all round appalling man. And Yen decided, so I think it was about, 6 months ago or so, he started making noises, kind of saying, actually, you know, I'm considering running. So he's not even said it yet, but basically he's now polling. I think that the most recent poll has him in the second round against Macron. So yeah, there you have it. Just delighted to have another one.
No doubt. Without being too much the kind of ignorant Englishman, why is France so prone to far-right politics? I mean, we've become prone in recent years, but France's history runs a little bit longer than ours. Why is this, do you think?
Ooh, I'd say sort of yes and no, because I mean, my first like counterpoint would be that we also had, you know, communists, especially at a local level, very well represented in our politics for a very long time in France in a way that Britain never did. So I think it's a kind of different political spectrum. I think there's a few different things as well. So on the longer run, it's the Le Pen family, the fact that, you know, there was the father first and then obviously Marine. And we've got even the niece at the moment, kind of, you know, so
there's another one. There's another one.
Well, did you not know about, Marion Maréchal Le Pen?
Oh, I missed this one.
She's the niece. My mum's convinced, like, she's going to be the one who's eventually, like, National Front president. They never end. So I think, it's A, the fact that we do have this kind of political dynasty of the far right, which I think, Britain doesn't have. But it's also, I think, if you look at more recent French politics, I think the problem is just that, you know, the traditional left and the traditional right have done a very, very bad job at remaining sort of like coherent and liked, etc. Because, you know, Macron obviously famously came out sort of nowhere at the last election and then created his own party and then managed to become president all in the space of, what was it, you know, about 6 months. So it's not, I think it's not just that France likes the far right at the moment. I think it's just that France is unbelievably tired of its traditional left and its traditional right and will kind of vote for anyone that's not that.
God, what a thought. Fiona, when we look at the countries with the worst COVID statistics, they often tend to be countries led by strongmen, populist leaders. They tend to lead the list. Trump, Bolsonaro, Putin, Modi, Boris Johnson as well. Why are populist leaders so bad at governing for the popular mass, you know, the people on whom COVID falls hardest?
Well, look, I think, you know, part of that is just the focus on division and, you know, politicization of everything. And a lot of that is driven by continuous public opinion polling. You know, certainly here in the United States, Trump himself, you know, very early on in the pandemic, decided that wearing a mask would look somehow not manly, would look silly. Obviously, he probably stood in front of a mirror and looked at himself in a mask and decided this was not going to be the look that he wanted. And so he starts making comments about not wearing a mask. And then, you know, that, of course, that translates into the way that, you know, people view this. There's the kind of whole politicization of sort of like the back and forth of key issues, trying to make them kind of resonate with themes. The anti-vax movement has really taken a hold here in the United States. It has elsewhere. I mean, the irony for Russia on this is that they played anti-vax propaganda, so did the Chinese, and it came back to bite them because Russia's got the worst infectivity rate and mortality rate right now than it has in the pandemic. Because on the one hand, it's spouting anti-vax propaganda to the rest of the world and talking down all the other vaccines while it was trying to talk up its own. And that reverberated back into Russia like a boomerang. Basically, people don't trust the vaccines writ large in Russia either. So you've only got 30-35% of people being vaccinated. So it's this politicization, it's this macho posturing, I don't want to look weak. I mean, this is what Bolsonaro does all the time, right? He says, oh, I'm totally fine, and disregard for experts and expertise because they've been talking everybody down. The populists don't want to have somebody else in the spotlight. I have to say, Boris Johnson did handle this much better than others by actually allowing experts and medical staff to step up and talk about things, even as he was kind of playing backwards and forwards. Because in the case of Bolsonaro in Brazil, he undercut his medical chiefs the whole time until they kind of quit. And of course, Trump did exactly the same. Modi in India, you know, hasn't really kind of given them much space. And Putin, although he seemed to kind of elevate the medical staff, was much more also focused on, again, this propaganda effort and also, you know, trying to gauge public opinion. Populism is just you and the people. And it's also trying to, in some respects, pander to the people's whims. And if you kind of think you're going to get a lot of traction, are you going to lose a lot of people if you start to impose mandates or try to impose public health, then you pull away from it. And this is the problem that we have. As you said, every single populist country has done really badly in handling COVID.
And yet it seems to have cemented many of those, not all of them, but many of those rulers seem to have been cemented during that period.
Well, we'll see, right? I mean, there's been a backlash maybe, you know, Marie and Yasmin might want to comment on this. There's been a backlash in Brazil. Mm. And in fact, in Italy, there's also been an interesting backlash. Many of the members of the Five Star Movement, for example, have distanced themselves because Italy was so overcome by the, it was the first mover, sadly, on the horrific infection rates and mortality rates. And the Italians have tacked more towards the centre. Most of the political parties and individuals. And, you know, the recent outcome of the election when they couldn't pull together a government. When the president of Italy, Mattarella, appointed Mario Draghi, people have been, you know, listening much more to Draghi. And of course, they've rolled out as their chief spokesman for the pandemic response, a general. I mean, he appears on Italian television in, you know, full uniform and, you know, giving people advice. I mean, it's literally taking the Surgeon General, as we have in the United States, to a whole other level. You know, so, I mean, this is really interesting to see that there are limits, because Italy, everybody could see that this was a real disaster. And Italian, you know, communities are much tighter, you know, perhaps, than they are in other countries. Still, people live with their parents. You know, they have close relations with their grandparents. It's a smaller country. The communities that were hardest hit were small communities at first. It wasn't just in the big cities. So, you know, I think that Italy shows us that there can be a different approach here, and that the populist politics can only play out for so long. And Germany, I mean, it's interesting to see how in the recent election, Alternative for Deutschland didn't get the traction that they did before. And people did start looking towards Chancellor Merkel and other, you know, kind of more conventional mainstream politicians during the pandemic. Not perfectly, but I mean, I think there's some glimmers here of a different path.
Yeah, Fiona, I'm not sure if you've had the pleasure of tuning into Tucker Carlson's latest documentary, Patriot Purge, but my colleague Anne Applebaum gamely agreed to watch it so we all wouldn't have to. And as she's written, the film is basically designed to sow distrust in American institutions, including those that I think, you know, have historically, at least, enjoyed a lot of support from the American right, you know, institutions like the military, the FBI. And I was wondering if you think that this sort of hatred of elites that we kind of hear espoused from Tucker Carlson and the like, if you think they're kind of morphing into sort of hatred of America as it exists and of American values, even just thinking back to Tucker Carlson's recent visit to Hungary with Viktor Orban, he was very much talking about Hungary as a sort of country that the U.S. and Americans should be looking to as sort of a goal or something to aspire to.
Yeah, I haven't seen the documentary. I've keep feeling that I ought to sit and watch it, even, you know, if Anne's watched it for the rest of us. I read that article as well and did think I ought to, you know, watch it for myself. You know, and I've read a lot of articles, including, you know, some from, you know, right-wing conservatives who have been on these visits. It wasn't just Tucker Carlson, of course, have been on these visits to Hungary and, you know, what they think Hungary stands for. It's really personalized rule in all of these instances of Orban. You know, well, Poland, it's very personalized by Kaczynski, who's actually out of office, but it's all about a certain clique of people and their own views and, you know, their desires to impose this on everyone else. And, you know, I can see that, you know, this is, again, fitting into this historical pattern, which you've, you know, obviously talked about and thought about as well, about times of rapid change, rapid demographic, social change, cultural change, economic change, all, you know, mashed together here. And we've got larger global change too, with climate change. Everything has the word change affected, appended to it here. You know, we're transitioning in technology. I think it's just too much for people to handle. And everybody's trying to look for that safe place, that familiar place. And, you know, certainly in the United States, that kind of idea of culture wars, that people who had adhered to the church, be they, you know, white evangelical Christians or Catholics or, you know, whoever the group is kind of focused on, who feel that their whole way of life has been challenged. I mean, this is what Viktor Orban espouses. It's this idea of a kind of a Catholic Christian Hungary, dominated, however, by Magyar Hungarians, not by anybody else. He's not a white supremacist. He's focused on a very narrow definition of Hungary and Hungarians. It's Magyar. I mean, it's not everybody else or anybody else. He doesn't want any kind of immigration. And it's similar with Poland. It's Catholic Polish Poland, you know, not white Polish, because it could be, you know, Italians and, you know, Romanians and, you know, whoever else coming in, Ukrainians. I mean, they don't want immigration of any kind. They don't want to be part of that European, you know, free movement of people. It's very conservative, inwardly focused, and focused on keeping a certain group of people in power and then playing to that base. So, you know, you're seeing that same trend in the United States. People are feeling that they're losing their sense of themselves as the country changes. The idea that by 2045, demographically, the United States will be a majority minority. You know, similar, you know, kind of feelings in Poland and Hungary on those edges of the European Union, looking at the massive changes that are going on. Zemmour in France that Marie was talking about, all talking about, which is interesting because Zemmour, of course, is Jewish. And, you know, in some of these other contexts would also be targeted. But he's, you know, kind of trying to shape a particular perspective in France, of the sort of a nationalistic conservative France that he can be part of. I mean, you see that in Russia as well, that many of the great advocates of kind of great Russian nationalism are not actually ethnically Russian if you start looking at their names and their family backgrounds. I mean, this is sort of a classic when you look at these times of massive change in Russian and Soviet history, you know, as well as in European history too. So we're at one of those tipping points, I guess we would say, historically, that we've seen in many different periods. And it's going to be a wild ride, and it's going to be very difficult to kind of imagine how we get out of this and to manage it. Because indeed, you know, whether Tucker Carlson means to or not, he's undermining that whole entire sense of a inclusive, you know, multi kind of cultural America that America always has been, frankly. It is a country of immigrants and immigration and different waves of immigration, and one in which demographic change has been happening all the time and industrial change. But, you know, he's basically saying stop it in the tracks. And stop it in the tracks are wanting to dismantle many of the institutions. And, you know, that I'm wondering how that fits in. This is almost a kind of a revolutionary moment in the United States.
The world's most indebted property developer is the Chinese giant Evergrande. It has liabilities said to reach $300 billion, from failed asset sales to suspiciously spontaneous payoffs. A bizarre series of events has left it again on the brink of collapse, unless the Chinese state intervenes. Its demise could put one third of Chinese property businesses at risk of default. So are we about to see China's Lehman Brothers moment? Sherry Feijiu is a freelance journalist, and she writes for the Financial Times in China. She explains this twisted tale.
My name is Sherry. My Chinese name is Fei, but I usually just go by Sherry. And in my bylines, you always see me as Sherry Feijiu. I have been writing about business news, market news, and just everything China for the past 6 years or so for the Financial Times. And I'm based in Beijing. So Evergrande is actually one of the leading property developers in China. If we're talking 1 year ago, like, nobody's gonna, you know, believe that they're gonna have this trouble. So they have been leading the market for years, actually. And they were one of the most trusted property developers in China. If you go to the major cities and also tier 2-3 cities, whenever they have new property projects going on the market, people will just, you know, like, rush into the market and buy their properties. But also what comes with that is that they, I think, currently the world's most indebted property developers. That means, you know, they've always been borrowing very heavily from banks, from other financial institutions, and also from their employees and the employees' families, their employees' friends, you know, as in the form of wealth management product. So it, everything basically started to go down in the past 6 months or so, I would say, because of the economic slowdown and also the slowdown in property sales in China in general. Because with COVID and everything, people are not as aggressive as before when buying homes and investment pieces in the real estate market. It's becoming such a big saga around the world, impacting, you know, thousands of investors worldwide. Nobody really knows whether Evergrande is going to make it, even if they manage to deliver some of their remaining property development projects. But the $300 billion debts is, you know, like a tremendous amount to actually be paid off. So if you're already holding investment assets in Evergrande, maybe it's time to sell off. But at the same time, we're seeing this more alarming trend among other Chinese property developers or property development companies, because the central bank and the Chinese banking regulator has been telling commercial banks and state-owned banks to put a cap on the lending amounts from property development, because the Chinese government doesn't want to keep lending to property developers forever. People are paying attention. The Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, has been putting a lot of emphasis on the so-called common prosperity. A skyrocketing property market is definitely not something that would lead up to a path down the common prosperity.
Mm-hmm. finally, in a particularly obnoxious week for politics, we thought we'd turn our minds away to the wider context, to the world that politics takes place in, not the papers, social media or broadcast, but music, particularly the age-old question of every political musician, can music that's about politics actually change your political opinions? There is a Billy Bragg album out. He's been trying to do it for years. Culture Bunker listeners will know this. Fiona, you're of a similar vintage to me. You grew up in the Northeast in the 80s, glory days of political pop, Red Wedge, Billy Bragg, the Kane Gang, Prefab Sprout, Miners Strike Benefits, all these things. Was music a big thing for you? Are you a big listener?
It was. I mean, you know, actually in my book, I mention, you know, kind of music, whatever I can. I got a lot of it cut out by the editor, but I, you know, talk in particular, you know, by the 1980s, that whole kind of feeling of deindustrialization. And I was very much, you know, kind of listening to things like, you know, the Specials, Ghost Town. Yeah. You know, later on, I listened to Prefab Sprout as well, by the way.
Of course.
Great County Durham band. Isn't that amazing? You know, kind of, and also the whole idea of a Prefab Sprout, everybody kind of, you know, what does that mean? But it was all, you know, very much a North of England kind of cult listening. I have to say that, you know, one of the big songs of the 1980s that I really listened to, and I guess he was on a tour recently, I totally missed it, was Matt Johnson and the
yes.
I think the Soul Mining. I must have played that album. It was just, you know, the year before I went to university, every single day, over and over and over and over and over again. It was the lyrics, it was the music. And I have to say, and, you know, probably I'll upset him because I'm so bloody old now, I love Sam Fender. I hope that doesn't kind of ruin his whole...
He's the teenage Bruce Springsteen. Cred. Yes.
Because, I mean, his music is so 1980s. I think if I was a teenager now in the northeast of England, I'd be playing Sam Fender's, you know, Hypersonic Missiles over and over and over and over again and, you know, learning all the lyrics. I mean, he just reminds me of that same, you know, set of singer-songwriters who just get it. You know, I heard his record company want him to cheer things up. I said, don't do it. No. Don't do it, Sam. Don't succumb, you know, to that commercialism. Keep it moody. Keep it sad and depressing. And that's kind of, he's captured the moment.
Can you put your finger on a time when a pop record actually changed your mind about politics? Because, like, you mentioned the Specials and you know, Nelson Mandela. I had never heard of Nelson Mandela until that record came out. And it actually brought the story to me, made me understand it and changed my mind about it.
No, I think that actually did have a big impact on me as well because of the Specials, aka, I was always listening to that. And when it was all whole free Nelson Mandela, I mean, I was all into that as well. As the same point, I mean, they really got people going. I can still sing all the lyrics of that in my head as well. A brilliant beat. The whole concerts that they had, bringing everybody's attention, you know, because I think, you know, when you're in that formative period, you're sort of late teens, early 20s, I mean, that's it. I mean, pop music, I had a whole soundtrack going on in my mind the whole time there. You know, if I had a soundtrack to my political awakening, that would definitely be part of it. And I think the Specials themselves, that, you know, two-tone ska, reggae, pulling that all together, the time of racial awakening for many people in the UK. It was a bit weird, you know, living in a pretty much predominantly white town in the northeast of England. But we were watching unfolding, you know, kind of a lot of the conflicts in the big cities. And the Specials right in the middle of that.
Well, that was the same. I mean, that was the same, except I was in the Northwest. And you know, we lived in a completely white area. It was like a handful of non-white people. But then the music just introduces you to another world of experience and another way of looking at things, isn't it?
Exactly. It opened my eyes to lots of things that were going on in the rest of the UK.
Marie, you are a mere child of what are you, 29? Young?
I am for 7 more weeks.
Seven more weeks. hang on to it. Does politics feature in your pop diet? I mean, can you pinpoint songs where that you think, actually, that has changed my perspective?
Not massively. I was trying to think about it because I don't know. I mean, I was basically brought up on a kind of steady diet of guitar music and sort of like indie stuff from the sort of, you know, early mid-noughties. And that was not, I feel like, you know, that was just kind of boys being sad about not getting laid, really. So I'm not sure that really massively counts as political. But yeah, no, because I was kind of thinking, obviously, at the wider question of, you know, like, can I think of anything that felt political? And actually, I mean, it's maybe slightly different. So when I was growing up, there was this band in France called Zibda, and they were all sort of like North Africans. And my mum, and they were like super fun, like genuinely good, fun band. But I do remember, because obviously so I'm half Moroccan, my mother's Moroccan, first generation immigrant. And I do remember at some point her putting the album on and saying, actually, do you also listen to the lyrics? Because I remember so one of their first albums was called Le Bruit et l'Odeur, so the sound and the smell, because Jacques Chirac once went to an estate that was mostly mostly Arab population. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, yes, I recognize the noise and the smell.
Oh, wow.
And so again, quite a political album. And I do remember as a kid, basically her sitting me down and going, listen to the lyrics, that this is kind of, this is the experience of, you know, like people who look and sound like me, etc. And as a result, kind of, you know, the sort of thing you come from. So yeah, that'd probably be my more serious answer.
Yasmin, how about you? Has a song ever sort of changed your mind or made you think differently about political issues?
I'm not sure about changing my mind. I mean, when I thinking about this, the first song that came to my mind, which is a bit more recent, is Childish Gambino's "This Is America," because I think you all probably remember when it came out, just being such a searing indictment of the country and kind of, you know, violence. I just remember that, like, being transfixed when that music video came out, because, like, it was both like really engaging and I couldn't tear my eyes away from it, but it was also really uncomfortable to watch. And these, like, random acts of, like, you know, I thought that was really impactful. But no, actually, kind of similar to Marie almost growing up, I remember, because I'm, you know, my family's Palestinian, being really drawn to this group called Dam, which are a Palestinian hip hop group that were formed in 1999 in this mixed Jewish Palestinian city of Lod or Lod. I don't necessarily know that it changed my perspective on political issues, but I think they've had a pretty big impact in terms of, like, you know, their Israeli fans, as well as folks further afield in the US and elsewhere who maybe aren't as familiar with kind of, you know, like, Palestinian art and music. And, you know, their music touches on everything from, like, the occupation to patriarchy and feminism and Arab society. You know, one of my favorite songs of theirs is Enemish Politi, which is, like, I'm not political. It talks about, you know, sort of faux coexistence and sort of living in a society that sees you as a demographic threat. This other incredible song that they do is Who You Are, I think is the English translation, which is the first real critique I've seen in kind of, you know, Arab music about, you know, sort of feminism in Arab society and the role of women. And yeah, I mean, even if you don't speak Arabic, you know, a lot of their songs have English subtitles. But yeah, they're just absolutely incredible. A really, really cool group. And I think quite popular in Israel as well, which is quite amazing for, you know, considering who they're made up of.
We should do this again on the podcast. It's like we should produce a playlist and give people stuff to take away and listen to. But we've kind of run out of time. So that's the end of this week's panel edition of The Bonker. Fiona Hill, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Andy. Thanks for having me.
Please do come back again. It'd be brilliant to have you on again.
No, I'd love to.
And thank you again, Marie Lacanze.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And to Yasmin Saran as well, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
We'll be back tomorrow with another Bunker Daily and the full-length show this time next week. I'll be back with a new Culture Bunker on Saturdays. Remember, if you like this podcast, send it to 3 friends to spread the word. And if you need something else to listen to, go to the link in the show notes. Doomsday Watch is available right now. It will amaze and blow your mind. If you'd like to support us on Patreon, search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out how you can do that. You will earn our gratitude and a shout-out at the end of the podcast. And here are this week's.
Oh, and many thanks from me to Jonathan Sharp, Richard, and Adam Bournes.
Best wishes and many thanks from me to James Morris, Jenny, and Matt Kenny.
And all the best from me to Kevin Brunson, Peter Weber, and Alan Cox. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all next time.
The Bunker was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison with Marie Lacanze and Yasmin Serhan. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yala Sofronievich. And audio production was by me, Alex Reese. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.